A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
What happens when a nation in grief decides it needs a villain before it needs an explanation? Daniel's prompt this week is about exactly that. The aftermath of October 7th, and the minute-by-minute scrutiny of the Prime Minister's actions that morning. He's asking whether this is a historically precedented witch hunt against a leader, or a legitimate demand for accountability. His core argument is that none of us have front-row seats to the workings of intelligence services or security, so the rush to judgment is premature. He points out that Netanyahu has said the army was authorized to declare a state of emergency, and in any well-run democracy authority is delegated. He's worried Israel is in danger of discarding a great statesman who's done enormous good for the country, based on a narrative that hasn't been tested by evidence. And he wants to know if there are other cases in history where the rush to resolve grief and find answers has resulted in witch hunts against leaders that were later proven catastrophically misinformed.
The Khan report is really the flashpoint here. It revealed a gap of roughly 3 hours between when Netanyahu was informed of the attack and when he called the IDF chief of staff. And that gap has become the entire story for a certain segment of the public.
3 hours. In the middle of a surprise attack that killed over 1,000 people, the demand is that a man who was woken up at 6 in the morning should have been on the phone with the chief of staff by 6:05.
And the bereaved families have been among the most vocal voices demanding a state inquiry, which is completely understandable. They lost children, parents, siblings. They want someone to answer for it. But the Attorney General has said the next government should decide on the state inquiry into October 7th. So the question of accountability has been punted into the political future, and in that vacuum, public speculation fills the gap. And speculation isn't evidence.
So let's start with what we actually know about the current situation on the ground. The Khan report, which is Israel's public broadcaster, found this 3-hour gap. Netanyahu has responded that the army was authorized to declare a state of emergency. The Attorney General says the next government decides on the inquiry, and the families are demanding answers now. That's the landscape.
And the tension is whether the scrutiny we're seeing is legitimate accountability or something more problematic. Because there's a real epistemic problem here, Daniel's right about that. We don't know what information was available at 6 in the morning. We don't know what assessments were being made. We don't know what the chain of command actually looked like in real time. The 3-hour gap is treated as damning evidence, but without knowing what Netanyahu was being told during those hours, the judgment is premature.
This is the ignorance problem, and it's not a small thing. The public assumes that a prime minister wakes up, gets a full intelligence briefing, and then makes decisions. But that's not how it works. There are layers of assessment between the raw signal and the leader. Someone has to decide whether a report is credible. Someone has to decide whether it rises to the level of waking the Prime Minister. Someone has to decide whether the Prime Minister can do anything useful in the first hour.
And that's the delegation principle. Netanyahu says the army was authorized to declare a state of emergency. In a well-run democracy, authority is delegated across organs of power. The Prime Minister isn't the sole decision-maker in a crisis. The military has its own chain of command. The intelligence services have their own protocols. The expectation that a single leader should have personally authorized every response misunderstands how modern states actually operate in emergencies.
I keep thinking about the phrase Daniel used, minute-by-minute analysis. If we applied that standard to any of us, any crisis we've ever handled, any bad day we've ever had, none of us would come out looking perfect. You had a patient crash in the middle of the night, Herman? How long between the nurse calling you and you calling the ICU attending?
It depends on the night. Sometimes I was on the phone within 30 seconds. Sometimes I was asleep and the phone was on the other side of the room and I didn't hear it for 5 minutes. And then I had to pee. And then I had to find the chart. And the parents are standing there watching me and wondering why I'm not moving faster.
And if someone later did a minute-by-minute analysis of that night, they'd find a gap. They'd find the 5 minutes where you were asleep. they'd find the 2 minutes in the bathroom. And they'd say, this doctor failed.
And that's the witch hunt mechanism. When a nation experiences catastrophic failure, the public needs a narrative. The most accessible narrative is individual culpability. It's simpler than systemic analysis. It's more satisfying. A person can be blamed, can be removed, can be punished. A system is diffuse. A system is hard to fix. So the scrutiny becomes forensic, examining not whether the leader made reasonable decisions with available information, but whether every minute was optimally used in hindsight.
At 6 in the morning on October 7th, the Prime Minister knows there's an attack. He doesn't know the scale. He doesn't know that it'll be the deadliest day in Israeli history. He knows what he's being told, and we don't know what that was. The 3-hour gap is only damning if we assume he was sitting there with full knowledge and chose not to act.
And the Golda Meir precedent is instructive here. Martin Kramer has drawn a direct line from Golda after the Yom Kippur War to Netanyahu today. The Agranat Commission investigated the 1973 surprise attack, and it actually cleared Meir of direct responsibility. The findings pointed to systemic intelligence failures, not individual malfeasance. But public pressure forced her resignation anyway.
So the commission says she's not personally responsible, and the public says, we don't care. We need someone to pay.
That's exactly what happened. And the question is whether that precedent represents accountability or scapegoating. Because the systemic failures that the Agranat Commission identified were real. The intelligence services had the information and failed to connect the dots. The military wasn't prepared. Those problems were bigger than Golda Meir, and her resignation didn't fix them.
But it gave the public something. It gave them a story. The leader failed. The leader resigned. The nation can move on. Except the nation didn't move on. The systemic problems persisted for decades.
But this isn't just a theoretical problem. There are historical precedents that should make us pause. The Dreyfus Affair is the classic case. A military tribunal in France convicted an innocent man of treason based on anti-Semitic bias and incomplete evidence. The rush to judgment nearly tore the country apart. And the public demand for individual culpability obscured the actual failures in French military intelligence.
Dreyfus spent years on Devil's Island before the truth came out. And the truth was that the evidence was fabricated. The real spy was still at large, and the military had covered it up to protect the institution. The individual scapegoat was the wrong target, and the actual problem went unaddressed.
The aftermath of the 2003 Iraq War is another example. Intelligence failures were attributed to individual leaders, but the systemic failures of intelligence agencies were the deeper problem. The public wanted a villain, and the villain was whoever was convenient.
And here's the thing about the Dreyfus case that's relevant. The public was certain. The evidence seemed clear. The conviction was popular. And it was all wrong. The certainty was the problem. The same certainty that says a 3-hour gap is damning without knowing what happened in those 3 hours.
The difference between accountability and scapegoating is whether the process is designed to find truth or to satisfy an emotional need. The Agranat Commission was designed to find truth. It found systemic failure. The public wanted a sacrificial figure, so Golda resigned anyway. Israel is in danger of repeating this pattern.
Daniel's argument is that Netanyahu has done enormous good for the country. The Abraham Accords, economic reforms, security policies that kept Israel safe for years. The danger is that October 7th becomes the single lens through which his entire legacy is viewed, erasing decades of achievement based on a single day's failures that may not even be his to own.
And that's a real risk. Legacy isn't a ledger where you add up the good and subtract the bad. It's a narrative. And narratives are shaped by the most emotionally salient events. October 7th is the most emotionally salient event in Israeli history since the Yom Kippur War. It'll dominate the narrative.
The counterfactual problem is worth sitting with. If Netanyahu had called the IDF chief of staff immediately, what would have changed? The attack was already underway. The terrorists were already crossing the border. The question isn't whether the response was perfect. It's whether any leader, with the information available at the time, could have prevented the worst outcomes.
And the public's ignorance of how intelligence and security operations actually work creates a fantasy of omnipotence. The fantasy that if only the leader had been faster, smarter, more decisive, the catastrophe could have been averted. That fantasy is comforting because it means the failure was a choice, not a structural vulnerability.
Because if the failure was structural, then the problem is bigger than one man. And that's scarier. That means the systems we trusted weren't adequate. That means the next attack could happen regardless of who's prime minister.
The deeper question is, what Israel actually needs right now? A forensic examination of one man's mourning, or a systemic review of how intelligence failures occurred and how they can be prevented? The witch hunt dynamic satisfies an emotional need, but it may actively prevent the structural reforms that would actually protect Israel in the future.
Every hour spent litigating what the Prime Minister did between 6 and 9 in the morning is an hour not spent asking why the border defenses failed, why the intelligence assessments were wrong, why the response was so slow. Those are the questions that matter for the future.
And the Golder precedent cuts both ways. On one hand, her resignation allowed the country to move forward politically. On the other hand, it didn't fix the intelligence failures. The next war, if it came, would be fought with the same systemic problems still in place.
And it did come. Lebanon in 1982. The First Intifada. The failures of 1973 echoed for decades because the Commission's findings weren't implemented. The public got its sacrificial figure and moved on, and the actual recommendations gathered dust.
That's the danger of scapegoating. It feels like accountability, but it's actually a substitute for accountability. The real accountability would be implementing the reforms, fixing the systems, ensuring the next surprise attack isn't a surprise.
Daniel's point about delegated authority deserves more attention. In any modern state, the Prime Minister delegates. The Chief of Staff has authority. The Head of Military Intelligence has authority. The Defense Minister has authority. The expectation that the Prime Minister should personally authorize every response is a fantasy of centralized control that no democracy actually operates under.
And in Israel specifically, the Prime Minister isn't the commander of the military in the same way the American President is. The chain of command runs through the Defense Minister to the Chief of Staff. The Prime Minister sets policy, but operational decisions are delegated. That's the design.
When people ask why Netanyahu didn't personally order a full mobilization at 6:15 in the morning, they're asking why the system didn't work the way they imagine it should work, not the way it actually works.
The system may have failed. That's a legitimate question. But the question is whether the failure was in the delegation, in the intelligence, in the border defenses, or in the individual decisions. Those are different questions with different answers and different solutions.
The Dreyfus case is the starkest warning. The public was certain. The evidence seemed clear. The conviction was popular. And it was all wrong. The certainty was the problem. The same certainty that says a 3-hour gap is damning without knowing what happened in those 3 hours.
The cost of the Dreyfus affair wasn't just one innocent man. It was the credibility of the French military, the trust in the justice system, the social fabric of the country. The scapegoat satisfied an immediate need, but inflicted long-term damage.
France spent a decade tearing itself apart over Dreyfus. Families split. Institutions discredited. The actual spy, Esterhazy, was acquitted and fled to England. The forgery that convicted Dreyfus was eventually discovered, but only after the damage was done.
The post-Iraq War accountability moment was similar in structure, if not in stakes. The public wanted individual culpability. They got it. But the systemic failures, the intelligence community's groupthink, the political pressure on analysts, the lack of rigorous scrutiny, those weren't fixed by blaming individuals.
The counterfactual question haunts all of these cases. If Dreyfus hadn't been convicted, would French military intelligence have reformed? If Golda hadn't resigned, would the Agronat Commission's findings have been implemented? We can't know. But the pattern suggests that scapegoating and reform aren't the same thing.
The risk of discarding a great statesman is that you lose the good along with the bad. Netanyahu's achievements are real. The Abraham Accords normalized relations with Arab states that had been enemies for decades. The economic reforms transformed Israel's economy. The security policies, whatever their flaws, kept Israel relatively safe for years.
The counterargument is that October 7th happened on his watch, and the ultimate responsibility is his. That's a legitimate argument. But it's different from saying he personally failed in the first 3 hours. Those are different claims.
The first claim is about structural responsibility. The Prime Minister is responsible for the systems that failed, regardless of what he did that morning. The second claim is about personal culpability. He knew, he delayed, he failed. The second claim requires evidence we don't have.
The public discourse is collapsing these two claims. The structural responsibility is being treated as personal culpability, and the personal culpability is being inferred from a timeline without context.
Martin Kramer's comparison to Golda is really about this collapse. The Agronet Commission distinguished between structural and personal responsibility. It found structural failures and cleared the individuals. The public rejected that distinction and demanded a head.
The public got ahead, Golda resigned, and the structural failures persisted. The distinction mattered, and ignoring it had consequences.
What does Israel actually need right now? I keep coming back to that question. A state inquiry that examines the systemic failures, the intelligence assessments, the border defenses, the response protocols, that would be valuable. A forensic examination of one man's mourning, that's theater.
Theater is the right word. It's a performance of accountability that doesn't actually hold anyone accountable. It satisfies the emotional need for a story, but it doesn't produce the reforms that would prevent the next failure.
The Attorney General's decision to punt the inquiry question to the next government means this debate will continue through the election cycle. The inquiry becomes a political weapon rather than a truth-seeking process. That's a problem.
Because a state inquiry should be above politics, it should be about finding truth. But if it's delayed until after an election, it becomes part of the campaign. It becomes ammunition.
The families deserve better than that. They deserve answers, not a political football. But the way this is being handled, they're going to get a political football.
Daniel's question about historical precedent is really a question about whether we ever learn. The Dreyfus case was 130 years ago, the Agronat Commission was 50 years ago, the Iraq War was 20 years ago, and we're still making the same mistake?
The mistake of certainty. The mistake of preferring a simple story over a complex truth. The mistake of substituting scapegoating for accountability.
The mistake of assuming that because a leader was in charge, the leader personally failed. That's not how complex systems work. That's not how intelligence works. That's not how crisis response works.
I think we need a different perspective on this. Hilbert, you've seen this dynamic before.
47 minutes. That's how long it took the Prime Minister to call the Interior Minister during the hostage crisis. The inquiry fixated on those 47 minutes. They reconstructed the timeline to the minute. They brought in phone records. They interviewed the aides. It was the centerpiece of the entire investigation. I was in the room for most of it. I was doing crisis communications for the government at the time. Small European country, mid-90s. A bus was hijacked, hostages taken, negotiations went badly. 3 people died. And the inquiry wanted to know why the Prime Minister waited 47 minutes to call the Interior Minister. The answer was that the Interior Minister was in a meeting with no phone access. He couldn't have done anything anyway. The call was a formality. The inquiry knew this. They heard testimony from the Interior Minister's staff. They saw the meeting schedule. And they still made the 47 minutes the centerpiece. Because the public needed a story. The story of a leader who hesitated while people died, that's a story. The story of a police tactical team that made bad decisions, a negotiation strategy that was flawed from the start, an intelligence failure that meant nobody knew the hijackers were in the country, that's complicated. That's not a story. That's a report. The Prime Minister resigned. He later told me privately that he was grateful for the inquiry because it gave him an excuse. He was exhausted. He wanted out. The public never knew that part. They got their villain, and the systemic failures were never addressed. The tactical team was never retrained. The negotiation protocols were never revised. The intelligence gaps were never closed. The next crisis would have the same problems. But the public felt better because someone had paid.
The inquiry served a purpose, just not the purpose anyone thought.
It served a purpose for the Prime Minister. It gave him a way out. It served a purpose for the public. It gave them a story. It didn't serve the purpose of making the country safer.
That's the part that sticks with me. The inquiry was a farce, but it wasn't a failure. It did exactly what it was designed to do, which was to produce a narrative. The truth was incidental.
The public doesn't want the truth. They want a story. The story of a leader who failed is more satisfying than the story of a system that failed because it's simpler. A person can be blamed. A system is abstract. You can't put a system on trial. The demand for individual culpability is baked into how we process trauma. When something terrible happens, we look for a cause. And a person is an easier cause than a chain of institutional failures. It's not rational, but it's human. I watched it happen in real time. The inquiry started with a genuine question about what went wrong. Within 2 weeks, it was a hunt for who to blame. The question changed from what failed to who failed. And once that happens, the truth is secondary.
The Prime Minister's private gratitude is the detail that changes everything. It means the witch hunt wasn't just an injustice, it was also a convenience. The public got their villain, and the villain got his exit.
The systemic failures got nothing. That's the part that still bothers me 25 years later. We spent 6 months investigating a phone call, and we never looked at the tactical decisions that actually killed people.
That story raises more questions than it answers, which feels appropriate for this topic. The question is whether Israel can find a path between the two failure modes, either scapegoating a leader based on incomplete information or refusing to hold anyone accountable.
The Attorney General's decision to defer the state inquiry question to the next government means this debate will continue through the election cycle. The way Israel navigates this moment will set a precedent for how democracies handle accountability after catastrophic intelligence failures.
Daniel's prompt raises a question that goes beyond Israel. How do any of us judge leaders in moments of crisis when we can never have full information? The answer might be humility, but that's not a satisfying answer for a public in grief.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the rush to individual culpability after catastrophe isn't accountability. It's a story we tell ourselves because the real story, the systemic story, is harder to face and harder to fix.
The hard part is that the systemic story doesn't give us a villain. It gives us a list of vulnerabilities, a chain of small failures, a set of reforms that will take years. That's a harder thing to grieve with.
The open question is whether Israel can resist the pattern. The Dreyfus case, Golda, the hostage crisis, they all ended the same way. A scapegoat, a story, and no reform. Maybe this time is different. Maybe the scale of the failure is too big to paper over with a resignation.
Or maybe the scale makes the need for a scapegoat even stronger. When the failure is this catastrophic, the demand for individual culpability is overwhelming. The systemic story is too painful.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts, the Human AI Collaboration Podcast.
If you want to send us your own weird prompt, email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.